Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. In this week's recording, we speak to Guy Foster, Brewing's head of research, about Brexit. But rather than posing too many hypothetical questions about the multitude of different paths this process could yet take, we focus on our core views, what we think will happen next and what we think won't happen next, and also what that means for the pound. And so hopefully by the end of it, you'll get a clearer picture of our position as it stands currently. And so hopefully you'll enjoy gems such as the following.
So that's why we think the no-deal Brexit, certainly in the near term, is a very low probability.
Okay, for more detail on why we've taken that particular view, as well as what we think is a high probability outcome, but again explaining the rationale behind it, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast and to a Brexit special. As myself, Ben Gutteridge, head of fund research, interviews Brewing Dolphin's head of research, Guy Foster. Now, there's many different ways you can take on this Brexit conversation, doing scenario analysis and lots of hypothetical questions. But what we thought we would do is ask Guy what his core view on the way Brexit is going to play out from here. Of course, we'll throw some questions at him because, as I said, Brexit can move in a few different directions. But essentially what we're trying to get at is where we think Brexit is going. I wonder whether Guy has extremely high confidence in this view. We'll get some more from that as the conversation progresses. And I guess you can make your own views. But we'll kick off then, Guy, with the under fire plan that Theresa May has proposed, this checkers plan. You know, is she about to embark on a pivot towards something like a Canada free trade deal? Or is she going to stay the course? And actually, is there any real need for her to make such a sort of a symbolic shift to a Canada free trade deal?
Well, I don't think there is a great deal of need for that shift, because ultimately that's the details of the ongoing relationship, and the ongoing relationship will be negotiated during the transition period. That was the purpose of having the transition period, was that you cannot negotiate the future relationship whilst you're still a member of the EU. That's part of the EU rules. Now, it was certainly originally an ambition, particularly of the UK government, to get something within the withdrawal agreement that would then set the tone for that ongoing relationship. So, for example, there was, it's widely rumoured that there was expected to be about 100 pages worth of the withdrawal agreement, setting out in detail aspects of the ongoing relationship. Because it was felt that the UK's negotiating position would be strongest at this stage, and that it would diminish a bit after actually leaving Brexit, after the actual sort of Brexit date, 29th of March. But ultimately, having spent 2 years largely sort of talking past each other, the UK and the EU now recognise the need to pare back those expectations, shift, kick that can into the transition period. And so what we would expect is that the withdrawal agreement itself, which is now expected to be about a tenth of the size that had been anticipated, will really feature some sort of fairly vague language about wanting to achieve frictionless trade, or having an objective to achieve frictionless trade and a deep sense of integration between mutually compatible economies, whilst of course not tying their hands to prevent the recovery of sovereignty that for many what this whole Brexit project was about.
Okay, so the Chequers plan or CTA, that can all be thrashed out during the transition period. All that needs to be done is get the withdrawal agreement signed, and that will contain some sort of spirit, the ambition of what they want to achieve. But the finer details are going to be thrashed out during this transition period.
Yeah, an ambition which will read very much like a Canadian-style agreement to some people and may read a bit more like a Chequers-style agreement to other people.
Okay, so we've had some relatively interesting news overnight about a potential extension to this transition period. Actually, just before this recording, Theresa May has acknowledged that they're thinking about it, but discussed it in terms of only a matter of months. I mean, is this a story or is it not, really?
I think it was a story, and now it's rapidly becoming not a story. To understand what this is about, you have to kind of go back to the central issue. The central issue that does need to be dealt with is the backstop. The ongoing relationship, fine, you can kick that into the long grass, but nothing can happen in terms of a withdrawal agreement deal without resolving the backstop. The backstop, of course, being what happens to the Irish border in the event that a better arrangement is not reached during the transition period. The ongoing relationship negotiation that we were talking about before. So, apologies for being long-winded, but because of the DUP's perspective, we know that the backstop can't be a border on, you know, between Northern Ireland and the UK. And I think there'll be a lot of other people in addition to the DUP who would share that view, who have these unionist sympathies. Then because of the Irish government's position, which comes through the EU's negotiating channel, can't be a border on the island of Ireland. And again, because of the peace process, I think there are a lot of people who would share that perspective. And so instead, it seems like the government had sort of recognised the need for the border to essentially be... The border to essentially kind of cease to exist within the backstop. So for the backstop to be that there isn't really a hard border, essentially that you have a high degree of regulatory commonality and basically single market membership for the whole of the UK at the end of the transition period. The important caveat being, of course, that the intention is that this isn't what happens. The intention is something better is negotiated during the ongoing relationship negotiation, but the reality, but the EU need that backstop to be in place for fear of causing a lot of economic damage to Ireland and quite possibly a lot of political and social damage as well.
So in relation to the backstop, which is causing a lot of toing and froing from all the parties, of the options available, you seem pretty confident that the timing is going to be a challenge, but at the 11th hour, presumably, the backstop will be effectively leaving the UK in the European constructs of the single market and the customs union, sort of an EEA type arrangement.
Well, look, I mean, confident is probably the wrong word, but it seems like...
Quite confident?
Certain. No, I mean, it seems like that is going to be the only way that you can reconcile the different interests of the different parties. And when I say reconcile, it would be, I think, a great disappointment to many people, which is why we're having this sort of in-depth discussion at the moment and why there is all manner of different wheezes being proposed to try and get around it, one of which is the idea of extending the transition period. The point there being that it enables the... By having a longer transition period, it makes it more likely that you can achieve a new ongoing relationship deal, and therefore it makes it less likely that you have to employ the backstop. So a longer transition period could appease the DUP, because it could mean that maybe they don't mind the backstop being on the Irish Sea, because it's less likely to happen because of the extended transition period. Personally, I don't think that will appease them. I think they've been fairly clear that it's just no to that backstop, no matter what. Similarly,
especially if it's only a matter of months.
Well, yeah, well, we'll get on to that. Yeah, okay. But, you know, similarly, I don't think it will appease the EU, which means that it's got to appease the hard Brexiteers who desperately don't want this this non-time-limited backstop of staying effectively in the single market at the end of the transition period. But I think those are the ones who are most likely to be able to find room to accommodate this. And that's because their alternative options threaten the very process of Brexit in itself. If they vote down the agreement, if they were to force a hard Brexit, if it turns out they're able to force a hard Brexit, those are the kind of things which could result in a second referendum or a change of government or something which actually destroys the legitimacy of that first vote. Now, yeah. What we heard overnight was that the latest entreaties from the Prime Minister to the EU fell on somewhat deaf ears. There wasn't anything new proposed. However, they seemed to be almost overtaken by these rumours of a proposed extension to the transition period that would take it possibly up to 2022, just before the next election. The EU seems sort of, you know, on board with that. Why wouldn't they be? But I think it's got an absolute roasting from members of Parliament this morning, and understandably so. We've heard, the Prime Minister describing it now as only being a matter of months, not years. In which case, I think it really doesn't change the probability of achieving a new and comprehensive ongoing relationship during the transition period. So I think it's going to go down in history as something that was alive as an idea overnight on a Wednesday in October, and then was very rapidly closed off the following morning.
So between now and March, there are some summits that have been, well, indeed, this one in October had been highlighted as a crucial summit, and now maybe in November, but it's not necessarily certain that that's going ahead.
No, it seems less likely that it's going ahead now, but it's, yeah.
But what I'm getting at is that you do anticipate, I mean, it's not too much of an assumption that, you know, this story will create a tremendous, will be a lot of back and forth and a lot of bickering, and this could create a lot of volatility in sort of sterling markets, or do you think the markets are sort of going to cotton on to the idea that actually, you know, there is no appetite for a no deal, and that sterling could somehow move away from being driven by political risk?
I mean, I think that sterling is assuming that there is very little appetite for a no deal, but it's still quite cheap at the moment. You would expect it to rise if that was ever confirmed, but it's certainly notable that it wasn't materially weak when the Prime Minister's pitch to the EU last night on Wednesday night was not terribly successful. So I think that probably the market is essentially saying, yeah, there's going to be a lot of fairly unpleasant news flow and back and forth, and you know, now it's an expectation. Yes, as you mentioned, the November summit is in question. Hearing increasingly the idea that it could go into a couple of weeks into December. No doubt policymakers will be desperate for it not to mess up their Christmas, but my guess is that it's got a good chance of doing so, and certainly it's suggested that it needs to be done and dusted with the EU by December, by the end of December, in order to go through Parliament in the spring, or the winter, I suppose, the late winter, and they're talking about deferring a holiday for MPs or a break for MPs in February because they'll need the extra time to get the legislation through. So I think everyone is now battening down the hatches, assuming an 11th or 13th hour agreement.
I couldn't imagine that would be well received by the electorate, the idea that MPs had their holidays sort of cut short. beyond March, on the assumption that there is a withdrawal agreement completed and a deal that sort of leaves a lot of scope for Brexiteers and Remainers to sort of attach themselves to, because there isn't the finer detail in there. And assuming it's sort of an end of 2020, end of transition, what are the stumbling blocks, or what is the likelihood of a deal being done? What are the stumbling blocks to actually take us into the backstop?
What are the...
So essentially, I guess I...
Why is everyone so concerned about the backstop when the backstop is not supposed to happen?
Well, no, the backstop's not supposed to happen, but is there a chance that actually, you know, it really could happen because the finer points in the negotiations are just so difficult to get over the line? And you talk, I guess the reference is, the immediate point is the Irish border solution. I mean, how do you resolve it? How difficult is it to resolve?
It still remains extremely difficult to resolve. I think the main issue is that to come up with it is... The statistic, I think, that everyone trots out is that it took 7 years to negotiate the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement with Canada. The counter-argument is, yes, but they were starting from not being members of the same economic union, whereas we would be starting from the opposite direction. But I think the reality most of those in the know would say is that there's a lot of legal stuff to take place, and a year and a half is not really long enough, which is why if you were a betting person, you'd be inclined to believe that whatever the backstop is, it takes some effect for some period of time. Maybe not, you know, not necessarily forever, obviously, but you might need another year or something like that. Now, in terms of your kind of direct question about is there going to be a resolution of the Irish border problem during that period of time? There isn't, essentially, or at least not a very palatable one. I mean, so one thing which could but probably won't happen is that the Conservatives could choose a new leader. That leader could choose to fight a new election. An election could take place. The DUP may no longer be a necessary component of the majority, but still, then I think there would be significant questions about how many, particularly Conservative MPs, would support any kind of deal that did divide the union, because I think its sympathies do go beyond just the members of the DUP.
Okay, so. We're in the transition, or we're into sort of April next year, and the withdrawal agreement has been signed. Does a leadership challenge then ensue? Because that is the moment then to sort of strike and lead the charge in the spirit and the direction of these EU negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is maybe, but not definitely. You would still be using up some time, of which you haven't got a lot of time, but... I think the principal hurdle or challenge to this is that if the Prime Minister were to be challenged in a confidence vote within the party by the 1922 committee through the submission of letters and all of this stuff that I'm sure people have heard lots about, then if she successfully beats off that challenge, then she's immune from it for a further year, and so they really only get they're only going to get one shot at this, and they need to have a strong expectation that they're going to firstly win this confidence vote, and secondly be happy with the candidate who ultimately gets chosen by the party as the replacement leader. And I think that's probably one of the That combination of factors is one of the things, or that second factor is one of the things that makes it quite a risky move to trigger the confidence vote in the first place.
Okay, so yeah, the negotiations may ultimately be taken in a direction not of their choosing. Those who sort of were intending to bring down Theresa May.
I think the Brexiteers would be likely to get a candidate that they would be happier with, but there may be enough. There is likely enough members of the party who don't want that particular candidate and who would really rather just the whole Brexit process got de-escalated and stopped sort of tearing the party apart, and for that, and feel that probably Theresa May may well be the best means to achieve that.
So on the basis that the Irish border solution isn't solvable, the transition period runs to the end of 2020. What happens at the end, towards we get to the back end of 2020, and there is no obvious signs that a deal is going to get done, which I'm sure will be the case, because even if a deal does get done, it will look tricky down to the wire. But what will the UK government ask for an extension to the transition period?
I mean, that depends what the backstop looks like. If the backstop looks like what we expect it to look like, then it's going to look a lot like the transition period anyway.
Okay.
I think the thing, you know, it will be a little bit looser, but in some fairly technical ways. And I think that's why it's better for hard Brexiteers to accept this unfavourable outcome, because at least then they will have had the vote to leave in 2016, and then the technical departure in 2018, and then the end of the transition in 2019, and then, you know, there will be another step further out in 2020, albeit, you know, they won't be fully out, but there'll still be a kind of momentum to it.
So we're currently, obviously, in the EU single market customs union. As of end of March, we step away into the transition period out of the EU, but still in the single market customs union. We try to thrash out a deal, but the obstacles are just too great. We then default into the backstop, which is effectively sort of a customs union single market arrangement. So really, you know, nothing changes economically in terms of relationships for the UK, as far as you can sort of see into the horizon.
The changes aren't huge and material. I think you are paying reduced contribution, but obviously nothing like the reduction that was famously suggested. And there hasn't been a reclaiming of sovereignty, but I think there will be, you know, there will, or there hasn't been a huge reclaiming of sovereignty, but I think there will be areas in which aspects of our ability to make our own rules will have been reclaimed.
And do you think, I mean, I know obviously Brexit is incredibly emotive, and there's lots of people making lots of sound arguments about how the UK could benefit from freeing itself from the sort of the chains or the shackles of this customs union. But I guess the market does seem to take courage from sort of a softer type arrangement, softer Brexit arrangement than a harder Brexit. So just, you know, playing that through, does that mean then that there is lots of upside in sterling, or is that moment of value realisation never going to become crystal clear, because there is, even though relationships don't change, it never becomes sort of set in stone that this is the final arrangement and nothing much has changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could get a revaluation, you'll get a positive revaluation on the news or the strong rumour that a deal is actually done. You get some sort of travelling in anticipation of that withdrawal agreement being signed. I mean, thereafter, it's important to just understand that Brexit's not the only issue in the world affecting the pound. The pound is one currency. You can only measure it in the terms of other currencies. So it's going to go down relative to the euro if euro economic performance improves, relative to the US if US economic performance remains strong. So there's a whole bunch of factors like that. But also, even if you just confine yourself to the geopolitical arguments, then there is clearly a significant and essentially unknowable balance of within the Conservative Party of people who do and don't favour a continuation of the current leadership. I think very few people would suggest it's been stunningly successful. And so there is a material chance of a leadership challenge. And that becomes, we've always felt that becomes much more material after March, when the when we're not working so hard to try and meet this extremely challenging deadline.
Okay, and then
and in the case that there is a leadership election, then obviously that has the possibility to sway the direction of the whole country, particularly if it might lead to an early election.
What is the final question? What is the probability of a no deal, disorderly Brexit, and what would be the consequences?
Well, I mean, I think the chances are very low, and so we have sort of modelled them to be in the 15% bracket, but I think probably, to be honest, that's too high. As I say, the point is that it just doesn't serve any individual party's preferences to have a no deal Brexit. I think it's economically bad, it's not good for Remainers, it's actually too risky for Leavers. I think that's a widely held belief now. It's something that probably wasn't believed a little earlier in the year, but because there's no preparations been made, they'd be better off taking this path, this particular no deal route, later on, you know, towards the end of the transition period, possibly during the backstop. I mean, I think that's what we're trying to understand at the moment, because it seems like the Attorney General, Geoffrey Cox, has been saying things in Poxy. Cabinet which have made which seem to have really prompted this sort of search for alternative ways to avoid the backstop, including this this proposal about extending the transition period. So maybe there's some particular kind of legal nuance that makes things harder in the backstop, but it's difficult for us to appreciate that at the moment. Still seems like you always have the option of repealing whatever legislation you want and bringing about a hard no deal Brexit if you really want to, and you would be in a better position to do that having made the necessary preparations, which only really materially started this year. So that's why we think the no deal Brexit, certainly in the near term, is a very low probability. What would be the consequences? Well, the consequences would be very grim. It would be, I mean, particularly for the pound. But I don't think anyone really appreciates exactly how grim they would be, because it's just an extremely complicated labyrinth of different sort of contractual agreements which rely upon the existence of the UK and the EU having an economic relationship.
Okay, well, a very complex subject, Guy. A labyrinth, this subject. So you've done an excellent job, I think, in giving us some sort of understanding of where this negotiation, relationship, divorce may go. So thanks very much for your thoughts. To listeners, we hope you enjoyed that. Do give us any feedback on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes, SoundCloud, however you listen to this podcast. But many thanks for listening, and we look forward to bringing you another podcast next week.